This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
Hey guys, this is Matt Mitchum diving headfirst into hide and seek on Joy 94.9. Oh, sorry. I was just trying to avoid saying point. I'll do it one more time just in case you think it's too inappropriate.
Now giving you more Dean Bank than any other radio station. Joy 94.9.
Sad but true, we're also here with the Naked Ninja. Craig is with us, and we are joined now by Tate, who's all the way up in QLD. Are you FNQ or just near NQ?
SEQ, I think it is.
Right. Well, thank you very much for joining us this evening anyway.
No worries.
The last couple of weeks we've been talking about Crystal, and we've been talking about, I guess, how an hedonistic lifestyle can have consequences in our life.
Yeah.
And... you know, I was thinking of all the people I knew who were willing and have been willing to share their story. You were one of them.
Yeah, and that would be hedonism has a place, but it also has consequences.
Firstly, because it's bloody good fun.
Exactly.
So let's go back to the fun bit. Start there. How old were you?
I was about 23, I guess, when I first started sort of really taking party drugs and having sex with more than just one person at one time.
So this wasn't just popping a pill on a Saturday night at a club?
No.
Right.
No, there was that was earlier in the, you know, during my coming out, but there were some serious party drugs involved on an infrequent basis at first, but as time went on, you know, addiction can take its toll.
How did you know? Because it's one of those things that often is described as not knowing when it's out of control, that it creeps up on you. You don't quite know when enough's enough, and you're not in control. Can you think back at that particular time and describe it for us?
Yeah, look, I think at first, you know, you tell yourself that, you know, it's only once a month, or it might be once every 2 months, and then it starts becoming once a fortnight, and then suddenly it's every week. And I always had a rule, that, you know, that was it on the week, you know, that was it, that quantity was, once I was through that, I then didn't go out and then seek more. And pretty much this day I've always kept that rule. It's just the quantity started getting larger and larger, and the party went for longer and longer. I think that the point where it became that I knew that I had a problem wasn't really until it started to affect my relationships with other people, and also my work circumstances. So it's like you start turning up on a Monday morning and you're still high, even though you've slept the night before, you're still high from the night before. And I mean, people at work, even though they may not necessarily know specifically what's going on, they know that something's not quite right because they know that you're not yourself.
Did it impact your work?
It did at different points, and there was one job that I had that I lost pretty much because the partying got out of control. I had, you know, I was grateful that I had my manager sort of protected me in a way. She knew what was going on because she'd seen it before. She'd been around gay men before, and so she, you know, and we'd had discussions where she wasn't necessarily talking about me, but I knew that she was talking about me, even though she was referring to, say, a third person. You know, like, I had this friend who, and she'd tell the story, and basically she was looking at me and she was knowing that that was my story. And I just, you know, I didn't show up for work for 4 days because I went on a bender. And during that time, I got a letter to my email, which was terminating my employment. So not only did I turn up to, I had to turn up to work to pack up my stuff, but I was coming down like any old bugger, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how long did it take, do you think, you know, to go from, say, using maybe once a month or so to you losing that job? Or, you know, how quickly was the decline? Was it, you know, kind of a linear thing, or was it gradual, or did it just kind of spiral out of control quite drastically?
No, it was, there were other mitigating factors. It was probably over about 5 years. And also during that time, the method of how I took the drug changed. So I went from being just a smoker to being an injecting drug user. And it was pretty much once I became an injecting drug user that it escalated pretty quickly then, because the quantities were higher.
During that 5 years, did it oscillate at all, or was it sort of a steady curve,
There were times that I did take off. You know, like I was able to, like, put 3 months between uses, mm-hmm. or 6 months between uses, and certainly that occurred also when it was spiraling. Like, there has been, I mean, since then, I'm in recovery now, and I haven't used for probably a good 9 months, at least. I mean, I don't really count it, but, you know, there were other factors contributing to it. So, you know, it came less about sexual pleasure or hedonistic pleasure, and it became more about coping strategies. So it's like I was stressed, I was stressing out, or I was feeling lonely, or I was feeling inadequate, or I was feeling, you know, not worthy of another person's affection. And so then that's what started to drive my use.
And I guess once you sort of get into that little merry-go-round, it's become self-perpetuating.
It does, exceptionally, because you start coming down from the drug, and then that's when all these ill feelings start harbouring themselves. You know, and also the other thing, the massive thing that changed was that I went from using it with other people to just using it by myself. So it was
no longer social?
No, and it wasn't about sex either. Like, it became less about sex. More about
function, like functioning in life.
Yeah, right. Pretty much, and coping.
Yeah.
And I, like, it's such a blurry line. You know, I'm able to look back upon it and see how things changed, but whilst you're in that, you don't realise things are moving along so quickly that, not really that quickly, but. Yeah, I mean, you're caught up in it, so you're not able to reflect upon what's actually really happening. You start to lose a sense of reality, because a lot of it is engaging in a fantasy world or an escapism from the real world.
We're speaking with Tate. He's sharing his story of crystal meth use and how that has affected his life. Tate, from what I'm hearing, there are sort of, I guess, like markers there are hurdles. One of them might be going from pills to smoking. One of them might be from smoking to injecting. One of them might be from having it just with sex in that environment. And then the next step on from that, if you like, is having it simply to function. Does that sound right?
I think that would be correct. And also, I mean, like, it didn't necessarily mean because I was using pills, I then went on to harder substances. I don't really believe in that sort of that slippery slope argument that if you smoke pot, then the next thing you know, you're going to be on heroin.
It all starts with pot.
Well, yeah, like, I don't necessarily agree with that kind of argument. it's certainly that might have been the way that some of it happened to me. But I think, yeah, definitely it went from being quite a social thing to being quite an antisocial addiction.
We'll take a short break and be back with Tate shortly. You are with Dean Beck and the Not So Naked Ninja here on Joy 94.9. Don't stop, no, I'll never give up, and I'll never look back. Just hold your head up, and if it gets rough, it's time to give up. They keep saying, don't stop, no, it's ever enough. I'll never look back, never give up, and if it gets rough, it's time to give up. Oh, but now I'm up. Don't stop, no, I'll never give up, and I'll never look back. Just hold your head up, and if it gets rough, it's time to give up. They keep saying, don't stop, no one's ever enough. I'll never look back, never give up. And if it gets rough, it's time to get rough. Oh, but now I'm falling.
Oh, is Dean rabbiting on about fisting again? Well, clearly you must be listening to Hide and Seek with Dean Beck and Andrew the Apprentice on Joy 94.9.
That's not
just
quite.
Just grab your lube and whack off with him, because if you can't beat him, whack off.
She doesn't shut up.
No, she doesn't.
Yeah, I know.
She's not quite right, because you're not here with the Apprentice, you're with the Naked Ninja.
I know, the not-so-naked Naked Ninja.
I know, come on guys, you got a message in.
We need a message for him to model his naked ninja outfit.
And if you have sent them, send them again, because they're not
coming through. Now, our guest is Tate. He's on the phone from Queensland, and we've been speaking about how basically Crystal got a hold of his life. What, Tate, tell us how you, what was the realisation that this was not sustainable? At what point?
I think it gets to a point. Well, I think I definitely went through a stage of denial that I was denying to myself that it wasn't an issue, that I was in control, that I was controlling it. And it wasn't until I get to the point where, you know, I'm pushing away my friends, I'm unemployed, and my health is deteriorating, that I actually had to get to a point of acceptance and admit to myself that I was suffering from an addiction. I think that the part of what helped was actually being unemployed. Even though I had all this time on my hands, and at first that had become a bit of a trigger to use, what ended up happening is, if I can't, you know, I've got to pay my rent, I've got to pay my bills, I actually don't have any more money left over at the end of the week to use. So it sort of almost became a bit of a benefit, was that because I didn't have a regular income coming in, I then had to put using as a less priority.
So you've told us how it's affected your life, you know, from various different points. So one of the things that I understand about meth use is that when you use it in the context of sex, it can come to a point in which you no longer enjoy sex, or you can't really have sex unless you're under meth. Has that happened to you, or have you not quite reached that stage?
No, absolutely. And it did get to a point where I couldn't have sex without meth. And look, even now that I'm in recovery and I haven't used for a while, I still find it, I'm not having sex with men. Two reasons. One is because sex can be a trigger. So it's like I don't want to be in a situation where I'm tempted to use again. But certainly that there's a part where meth has overstimulates the imagination parts of your brain, and so it gets to a point now where it's like it's almost like ordinary, just sober sex seems to be like a bit of a barrier. Like there's certainly a reluctance to want to be to do that, because I've been in such a fantasy world. You know, and I think part of it also being in recovery is that I've got to build up my confidence again, you know, and it's not necessarily, you know, going out and having casual sex with men isn't necessarily going to rebuild my confidence in the way that I want it to.
How have you sought advice as to how long you this path is going to take to fully recover from? I mean, how long are you going to become a fully functioning sexual person again, I guess is the question.
Yeah, look, I mean, I still masturbate. I mean, some...
Thank God for that.
I mean, there was a period of time where I just wasn't even masturbating at all, but, I mean, I'm past that now. I think, you know, part of my youth was that I mean, as much as I enjoyed my sex life, and I have, and I don't have any regrets about the sex life that I had, I'm now, I think, at a stage in my life where I'm actually looking for something a little bit more meaningful. And so, you know, I need to get myself into a position where, you know, I'm confident about myself. I'm putting myself out on the dating scene. And, you know, I'm searching for someone to have a meaningful connection with and have some meaningful sex with. And that's not necessarily easy in Queensland. You know, there's not as large a gay population, and also because I'm HIV positive, there's even, you know, and I'm wishing to serosort in order to minimise my risks of transmission. There's even less pos guys up here than there are, say, in Melbourne or Sydney.
Smaller pool of talent, so to speak.
Much smaller. Frustratingly so. I went a couple of weekends ago. I came down for a trip to Melbourne to catch up with my friends, and it was just like I was getting checked out left, right, and centre from these gorgeous men walking down the street. I was like sort of kicking myself, going, "Why am I living in Queensland right now?" But I mean, I don't know about you guys, but today it was, you know, mid-20s.
So. Yeah, you're boring me. Shut up. now, you also contracted hepatitis C, was during that phase where here in Victoria we saw some 39 cases of HIV-positive men contracting hepatitis C. It was around that time. And you underwent treatment for that.
Yep.
I believe it's not a lot of fun.
Yeah, look, I mean...
Hello, are you there? We seem to have lost Tate for the moment. We'll get him back on the phone very, very shortly. But in the meantime, let's have a track, shall we? Look, you know, could be anything, could be this. You're listening to Joy 94.9. You're listening to Hide and Seek on Joy 94.9. It is your show for exploring sex, sexuality and self. We have had a few messages come through on 0427-JOY-949. It looks like the SMSer has finally decided to work. Except it's just one person sending the messages. Thomas, thank you very much. And we shall tweet very shortly what the naked ninja wears when he is... naked and ninjuring.
Yes, the fabulous prize that we've been talking about.
The fabulous prize that I really don't know why we bothered. But anyway, why we should be bothering is because Tate is on the other end of the line. He's still in Queensland and we got knocked off our perch earlier. We were talking about Hep C and Tate, you were saying treatment regarding Hep C.
Yeah. I mean, first, before that, I mean, the Hep C, when I got it, it wasn't when I was injecting. So the likelihood of it was, and there was a study I was involved in with the, you know, all the medical research and all that sort of stuff, was that it was sexual transmission. And so it's still blood to blood, but there's a higher risk through things like sharing toys and fisting and group sex. that aside...
And prolonged sex over hours and hours and hours.
Over time. Yeah. So, yeah. So it's usually involving party enhancers of some description. They also said... someone said to me, like an Amyl bottle, like if you got that up against your nose and it burned and then it started bleeding and then someone else sniffed it, that could be another way.
But I guess also if you're on Viagra to keep your dick hard and you're on drugs to keep you going, you can go for hours and hours and hours and hours.
Hours and hours, and that's where you're going to get friction burns and all sorts of things going on.
Yeah.
But I would tell you what, like the treatment is the treatment as it was then was pretty nasty. And it did actually mean that I didn't use during the period that I was on treatment. It was 5 tablets a day and weekly injections into the stomach. And I suppose the other thing about the treatment, it wiped me out. It was like it was a form of chemotherapy. It had a bad effect on my appetite. It made me sleep during the weekends because of the dose, and then I would have insomnia during the week, and I didn't know, I was forgetful, like I had no short-term memory, so I wouldn't remember what I'd done that morning or what I'd done the day before, and sometimes it was almost like a psychosis. So I had, you know, I had moments where the trees were talking to me, or the nature talked to me a lot, actually, which was quite bizarre. It wasn't disturbing at the time because it was quite pleasant, but looking back on it, it's rather disturbing. The good news is unfortunately, the treatment didn't work for me because of the genotype of hep C I had.
All of that carry-on for nothing?
Yeah. It pretty much. Well,
oh my God.
Not for nothing, because there still was 60% chance that it would work.
Oh, okay.
I still take the advice of that the doctors gave me, saying try and treat early. I still would do the same again, because I trusted them and the advice was sound. It just so happened that particular type of medicine, you know, I probably needed another 6 months on the treatment, but my body and my mind just didn't handle it. I suppose, the good news is that they're now developing treatments that are a completely different class of drugs, and, the clinical trials are showing that they're getting, something like 98% success rate in only 3 months and not as negative side effects. So, there is light at the end of the tunnel, and it's coming very shortly. I've just got to be patient, basically, and in the meantime, look after my health.
Indeed. You're a few years down the track now. You've still got the co-infection, but how are you, and how important was it for you to move, to geographically relocate elsewhere?
I was at the time, I was considering doing a second course of hep C treatment. And so I thought, I don't want to do it. I knew the factors that contributed to me not doing very well whilst I was on treatment. So that was like, I wasn't getting enough exercise, I wasn't eating enough good foods. And part of that was because of Melbourne. It was winter. You know, we all know what Melbourne winters are like. They're bloody horrible. And I just thought, I can't do another course of treatment whilst I'm in Melbourne again. I need to get out of here. And then part of it also was to be able to start getting some help for my addiction and substance abuse. And so, that was a big factor in me deciding to move up to the sunny state, just to kind of get away from it all, put some distance between myself and some of the contacts that I don't really want to have in Melbourne anymore. And, and part of that process has also been, going through my phone and deleting fuck buddies who I, used to use with, and, or people, connections I used to score drugs through. And, I've had to be quite strong in understanding that for me, casual partying is probably not an option anymore. Mm. You know, it's just too dangerous for me to want to be able to slip back into, you know, using on a frequent basis again. So, you know, it's a bit sad that, you know, I enjoyed my time. I had a great time, and I still say I wouldn't change anything because I've had, you know, I've lived my experiences and I've made choices that are informed, and I, you know, maybe I wouldn't make some of the same choices again if I was given my chance, you know, if I was given time to turn back and change things. But ultimately, sitting here, I'm a happy individual and I've learned a lot about myself.
And we have learnt a hell of a lot because you have been willing and brave enough to share your story with us tonight. Thank you so much for doing so.
Yes, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
That's Tate in Queensland sharing his story, and what a tremendous and powerful story it is. We'll come back with some texts and things that have been coming in throughout that conversation. You are with The Naked Ninja and Dean Beck on Hide and Seek.
Guests appearing on Hide and Seek provide general information only. What you hear on the show should not replace consulting your mental health professional. If you're in need of immediate care, please call Lifeline on 13 11 14. In an emergency, always contact 000.
Hide and Seek. Great radio. Joy 94.9.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.